Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the series that we're doing called Unlock, based on the book by Edith Eger called The Gift. And I just want to begin, as we always do, with a little bit of a review from last week. So last week we discussed the prison of self-neglect. And we talked about the concept that we need to have a strong self to go beyond ourselves. So growth needs a strong self to begin with, to do all the things that she describes in the book, like move away from victimhood, express and confront negative emotions, move away from negative guilt and shame and so on. All these things need a strong self, and it needs a belief in oneself to be able to do it. So we discussed that we need to move away from the three things that we depend on often, which is attention, affection, and approval, which we need as children, but we need to grow out of it and not define ourselves by those things coming from other people, and to move towards discovering our true inner self, our true definition of who we really are. Now, we spent a few moments last week clarifying that strong self and setting boundaries and are all very, very important things, but sometimes can be misunderstood. Because we discussed the idea, an important idea, that insecurity should not be, in other words, being fragile and being insecure with oneself should never be replaced by being overprotective of self and putting forward oneself beyond other people. That's just more of the same in a different way. But rather we talked about this idea of I, the ich, we told a story about a person who's focused on I is a real problem. Just to mention Rabbi Sacks, who passed away a week ago, he has the famous line where he says, as a society, we need to move away from I to the we. So we talked about this idea that selflessness is a real value. The only thing is it needs to come from a strength. So yes, we need to have a belief in ourselves. We need to understand our intrinsic value, but we still need to be selfless. In fact, we need to be more selfless and generous and kind and giving, but coming from a strength. And when needed, we need to be able to create that boundary, as Abraham Avinu did, as we explained last week, in great depth. Now, moving on to today's topic, the chapter in the book is actually called The Prison of Unresolved Grief. So let me just give a little introduction. 2 weeks ago, when we had the chapter on expressing emotions or expressing even negative emotions, where Edith Eger put forward this idea that the opposite of depression is expression. And I gave the example of, from Jewish thinking, about the concept of grief and how we mourn, and explained that it's really not just about grieving a loss of someone, but it's about general, our general grief, our general human experience. And I didn't realize actually at the time that I'm reading the book together with you, and I didn't realize that there's a whole chapter on this. So I'm going to revisit this, but in this chapter she makes some very important points regarding grief, but also regarding how it extends to all of human experience. And I want to explore today some of those ideas that she talks about in this chapter. So I want to just first of all read a couple of opening paragraphs and then explore them a bit. So she writes, she says, one day two women came to see me back to back. The first had a daughter who was hemophiliac. She'd just come from the hospital and she wept the whole hour, feeling the intense pain of watching her child suffer. My next patient had come from the country club. She also spent an hour weeping. She was upset because her new Cadillac had been delivered and it had come in with the wrong shade of yellow. So on the surface, her reaction seemed out of proportion, her tears unearned. But often, she says, a minor disappointment represents a larger grief. Her sense of loss wasn't about the Cadillac. It was about her relationships with her husband and son, the sorrow and resentment she felt that her desires for her family went unmet, and so on and so forth. And then she goes on, she says, these two beautiful women reminded me of one of the most fundamental principles of my work, how it is a universal experience for life not to turn out as we want or expect. Most of us suffer because we have something we don't want, or we want something we don't have. Beautiful line. And then she continues and she says, all therapy is grief work, a process of confronting life when you expect one thing and get another, a life that brings you the unexpected and the unanticipated. And then she ends off by saying, grief is often not about what happened, it's about what didn't happen. And that's a really important line which we'll soon explore. So if you take these couple of paragraphs, there's actually three very important points which I want to highlight. And the first goes like this. The first, we have a concept in Jewish terminology called Simchas HaChaim, Simchat HaChaim, which literally means the joy of life. Right. That sounds loosely translated. And it describes a person who's got inner happiness, who's got inner contentment with life. People who are always choose to be happy rather than right. People look for good on a regular day. People who look beyond the surface of challenge and see beyond the superficial and see the depth and the opportunity which hides behind the surface. People who have the ability to see things properly. You know, I once mentioned this, I think, and I want to just sort of pause here for a moment. Every single morning, we have the morning blessings. We call them morning blessings. And some of these morning blessings are about gratitude. We ask God, you know, we thank God for the eyes to see, for the clothes that we wear, for walking around, for getting up straight, for taking away our fatigue through sleep, and so on and so forth. One of them, on the surface, thanks God for the ability to see. And the way it reads is, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Pokeach Ivrim. God, we bless God who opens the eyes of those who are blind. And it's a very strange terminology, it's a very strange phrase that the blessing uses. Why don't we just say, thank God for the ability to see. Why for everyone to see? Why those? And what does it mean to open up the eyes of the blind? If someone is blind, they don't see, right? But the commentaries explain that this blessing is not just a expression of gratitude, but it's also a request. It's a tefillah. It's a prayer for God for the coming day. That when we get up in the morning, we ask God that we know this day is going to have all sorts of different components. We know the day might have ups and might have downs. It might be a fantastic day or there might be some bumps in the road. What we ask God is, Pokeach Ivrim, open up the eyes of the blind. In other words, there are two types of seeing. There's physiological sight where you see the object in front of you, and then there's true sight. True sight means to see something properly, to look at something with the right perspective. Right? I think when I shared this with you, I probably told the story, but let me tell it again. My wife and I, Dina and I, were once in the Blue Mountains just having a couple of days off. And it's the most exquisite place and it was beautiful scenery. And then the next morning we decided, you know, we'll get up early and we'll take a real nice long walk. Just to, in the context of the majesty of the mountains and the beautiful views and so on. We walk outside the cabin where we were staying and there's an incredible fog. I'd never seen anything like it. And you couldn't actually see more than two steps around in front of you, like a meter in front of you, you could see. But we're already there, and we've come all the way, so we say, you know what, let's just go a few steps, and we'll see if we can walk a little bit, even though it doesn't seem like we can see anything. And we start to take a couple of steps, and I notice a very interesting thing. Every few steps we take, you can still see a meter ahead of you. And we kept doing that, we kept walking, and then suddenly, after about 20 minutes, the fog lifted, and this incredible beauty just emerged. And I thought about it, you know, I always tell you that the Baal Shem Tov said you have to learn something from everything. I thought about the amazing lesson in this, that often we get up in the morning and we can't see the majesty, we can't see the beauty. We can't see the majestic view, we just can't see it. But we can take a couple of steps forward and we can attempt to see it. And we can ask God, Pokeach Ivrim, open up the eyes of the blind. Let us see what's really behind this thin, almost non-existent fog. And when we take a couple of steps forward and we come with that determination, the fog lifts. And suddenly there's this beautiful view. So there are people that sort of have this, but that's their kind of personality. You would say, that's the type of person I'm describing. You know, him or her, Simchat HaChaim, they have joy of life. They're able to see the good. They choose happiness. They they They're upbeat, they're positive, they're optimistic, they're forward thinking. Then there are people who are just plain miserable. I'm talking in extremes here because obviously, to bring out a point, we're always talking extremes. There's a lot of gray area in the middle, but this is just talking in extremes. There are people who are just plain miserable. These are people who are not particularly pleasant to be around. Everything is a problem. Everything is unfair. And everything and everyone is out to get them, right? You get the picture. I'm sure everyone knows someone like that. Now, when I talk about this negativity, I'm not talking about being stuck in the journey of the response to something really tragic, like a response to a tragedy. That's very different because resilience is a tough journey. Everyone responds differently. It's a difficult path. And not everyone succeeds at the same rate as everyone else. And that's perfectly normal, perfectly understood. Although it is possible and people need to work on it, but that's different. I'm talking about response to a regular day. Every day we'll have a fog. And every day we'll have people who notice the beauty behind the fog, and those people that define the whole day by the fog. So that type of thing, that being negative, that sort of being so upset and tense and stressed about the darkness of the day, so to speak, often that's personality based. It's personality based. It's just who the person is. There are people born that way. Now they can work through it. They can change. We know that change is possible. We believe in change. But nevertheless, it's sometimes just sort of inbuilt a bit, and that's hard. That's a challenged personality to have, and some people are born with that challenge. However, sometimes it's not about that, right? You know, also sometimes it's a personality just to be negative. Sometimes a personality, some people have a personality of a very, very deep sense of fairness and justice. Fairness and justice, by the way, are two very important things, but to have that personality of fairness and justice is really hard. You know, the kid that everything is not fair, right? Some adults do that too. Everything has to be just. Everything has to get their right share. And everyone has to be held to account all the time, every time, every day, and so on and so forth, right? So that's a challenged personality. But sometimes it's actually not a personality. Sometimes this type of approach of being so dark and so negative towards the day that every little thing sets us off or brings out an incredibly negative, disproportionate response, sometimes it's part of a bigger issue, as the woman with the Cadillac was. Right? It means it's a person who's just experienced something a lot bigger, a lot more difficult, a lot more challenging. And it's making the particular individual extremely, extremely sensitive, extremely fragile, that everything seems dark. You know, it's that analogy that I once shared with you from Rabbi Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Twersky, who says you can give someone a very, very light tap on the shoulder, and it's nothing. It's just a friendly touch. But if someone has a sunburn, that little touch can set them off to experience and to scream out in extreme pain. Right? So often we're very sunburned because of circumstance, or because of circumstance that we haven't responded to or handled properly. And we need that, or we call in Hebrew, we need that cheshbon hanefesh. We need that reflection. We need to stop at those kind of things. You know, we know it ourselves, sometimes we have a bad day and we're snapping at everyone and we're so unhappy and we're just so negative, we're not even sure why. So it's time to stop. It's time not to be trapped like the person with the Cadillac, but to actually make a cheshbon and to reflect, why am I so unhappy? Why am I snapping? What is unresolved? What am I going through? What am I losing? What have I not accepted? What have I experienced that I haven't worked through that's making me this fragile and this tense and sensitive? What have I buried deep down within my emotions that I'm not confronting, that I'm not looking at, that I don't want to, I'm escaping from, and I'm rather channeling my feelings into something much less, with much less consequence and much less important? In other words, sometimes the person who's snapping the most stupidest things is because they really need to be snapping. They need to be working through a much more difficult issue, but they don't want to confront it, so they're escaping. They're burying the issue, as that lady did. They're burying the issue deep down, refusing to notice it, refusing to confront it, refusing to work it through, and letting out the raw and negative emotion as something inconsequential, just really stupid. And therefore, we need to know what that is. We need to actually find what it is. We need to think. Maybe what's really bothering me is that conversation I had last night. Maybe what's really bothering me is just my job, which I really don't like at the moment. Maybe it's my career, maybe it's my relationship, maybe it's something else. Maybe it's someone said something to me, whatever the case, maybe that's really what's bothering me. It's not the silly things. It's not that I got home and there was a bit of mess on the floor, so I exploded with my children. No, it's something bigger than that. And when we do that, we have to do three things, which we're going to talk about a bit more. We need to do three things. We need to identify what it is. We need to express, as we learned a couple of weeks ago, and then we need to heal, which we'll talk about in a moment. So those three things are really important. When we're struggling with something, we're not even sure what it is, we need to identify first what it is. We need to express it to someone, and we need to heal. Now, when I say express it, and I said this a few weeks ago, it doesn't mean broadcasting it to the whole world and social media and so on and so on. It means broadcasting it or sharing it with a friend, with someone close, with a mentor, someone you can trust, someone who won't judge you, someone who will accept you, but someone who will help you and support you work through it. There's a verse in the book of Proverbs, the book of Mishle, where King Solomon says, "Da'aga belev ish," a worry, an anxiety, a problem, a struggle that is within the heart of a human being. King Solomon gives us an instruction what to do with it. It's in one word. The problem is that one word can be translated in different ways. So I'll just give you two of the translations. The word is yashchena. Da'aga belev ish, the worry within the heart of the person, yashchena. Now what does yashchena mean? So it's got two opposite translations. One is remove it, discard it, to be masiyach da, to just stop thinking about it. The other is yisachena sicha, to talk, share it with someone. Well, how can you discard it if I'm sharing it with someone? And the answer is very simple. As in different words, as Edith Eger said in the chapter we did 2 weeks ago, in order to heal, in order to remove it, in order to respond and to let go, you need to first express it. So the two translations are spot on. Express, and in many cases, sometimes a person can learn to let go on their own, but very often it actually requires sharing, because that's part of the confronting process. We need to share it. And when we share it with someone, then it's clearly identified. It's born into the world, so to speak. It's now a real thing. It's not just something in the recesses of our mind in some sort of hazy, cryptic sort of formula. No, it's something I've articulated. It's something real. It's something I've shared. It's something I've let go of the burden, or it's something I've brought someone else in to help me share that burden. Whatever the case, it might be something really stupid, but it doesn't matter. It's a burden nonetheless. And when I've done that, then I can move to the second interpretation of that verse. I can let it go. I can remove it. And removing it is just step one, but really the process is then followed by the concept of healing. We need to heal. Which leads us, that healing process needs to be understood, because it leads us to the second point. Okay, so just to summarize. The first point, based on that woman with the Cadillac, is really that we need to identify what's really bothering us. Sometimes it's a crazy response, a disproportionate response. You know, we often say, we say about someone, you know, person, I don't know, they're really acting strange. And there's no reason for it. Well, there is a reason for it. It's just not the reason they want to confront and they want to share with you at the moment. So part of that is really learning how to identify and then expressing what is really at the heart of the problem. Which leads us into the second point that she makes in those few paragraphs. And she says a very interesting line. She says, all therapy is about grief. And let's understand that. We talked about grief a lot 2 weeks ago, where we talked about, and we've talked about this another time as well, where the Talmud really mandates the person to express their emotions through the grieving process. Yiddishkeit has this incredible formula of balance where it mandates and it prescribes the mourning process. And as we said, it's really an amazing formula that gives the person almost forces the person to express what they're going through and to articulate it and share it and then move on afterwards. But really, it's just a model. It's a model that needs to be applied appropriately to lots of different situations. And the reason for that is the way she explains it in this chapter is the following, and this is true on many levels. Much of the way we live life is about expectations. We expect things to happen. Things that we meant to have. Things that we meant to have in a particular way to be used and expressed and implemented in a particular way. This can be big things, it can be small things. And sometimes life does not work out according to our expectations. Sometimes a member in our family is not as well as we expected them to be. Sometimes the career that we chose for ourselves didn't work out. Sometimes it's loss of a relationship. Sometimes it's discovering that the relationship you thought you have is not the relationship you have. All of that is about a loss. When she says that grief is not about what happened, it's about what didn't happen. It's about a loss. We've lost something. We had it in our reality because we expected it to happen. So we wake up in the morning expecting 25 things to take place. Some of them are very significant and important. Some of them fall apart or more long time and don't work out. So we've lost those things because when we expected those things, we had it. We had it in our mind. We built the house in our brain. We had the career in our psyche. We were living that relationship according to the way we thought it was playing out. And then suddenly it's not there. Our expectation is not met. So we've lost something. When you lose something, you need to go through the process of grieving. It doesn't have to be as intense as tragedy, but there is a process. Part of that process is just like grief. Learning if it's really important to us and it's bothering us is learning to express it, learning to identify it, learning to express it. You see, that's why that identification process is so important, because this is where loss of expectation is so different to regular grief. Regular grief is when there's someone who's alive and they are no longer alive. So the loss is real. It's tangible, it's finite, it's final, I should say, not finite, I mean final. And therefore, the identification process is very, very clear. It's the grieving that needs to happen, and then it's the accepting that needs to happen, and so on and so forth. But what has happened is very clear. When we grieve daily expectations, things that even really bother us, short-term or long-term, it's very hazy because we kind of hope maybe it'll turn around. We didn't see the thing to understand its loss to begin with. And therefore, it needs even more that the application of this part of the process and part of the journey to understand what happened. What understand that I expected something to happen and it didn't happen. I once had a conversation, a series of conversations with a person who came to talk to me because they were having a lot of trouble with, she was having a lot of trouble with her mother. And essentially it boiled down to this, to the following. It boiled down to this idea that children, no matter how old the children are, no matter how old the parent is, we have this child-parent relationship. And part of that is that we expect certain things to happen. We expect them to be warm to us. We expect that the things that are important to us should be important to them. We expect them to love our children, their grandchildren in a particular way, and so on and so forth. We expect a relationship, and we all almost depend on that relationship. We never stop being a child. And then this person described how, and this happened more than once really, but I'm just thinking of one particular case where they described how it is always hurt because there can be a birthday party in school and for no good reason the mother just doesn't show up. And so on, and lots of things like that where there's just not the relationship, and she keeps hoping that maybe she'll be a mother, maybe she'll be a grandmother, it just never happens. And we went through this process exactly, and again, I don't do therapy, as you know, but it was a very clear thing, so I shared it with her. And I said to her very, very clearly, the problem you're having is not your mother, because your mother is not going to change. Or at least that's what you have to assume. I believe in change, but not changing other people, as we know. You can only change yourself, but part of that changing yourself is very simple. You need to understand that you've lost something. The mother you expected, the mother you had, the mother you think you had, which you never really had, that mother that you had in your brain, not on the ground in real life, but the mother that you thought you were experiencing is not there. Understand that. Make that final. Because then you'll be able to move along. Make that final and then grieve it. It'll be painful for a while. You express it to other people. Share it with someone. It's going to be very painful. You have to grieve a loss. It's a loss of expectation. It was kind of the first time, I'm going back to this particular incident because it was the first time I did this so clearly with someone. And it was just amazing to see a transformation. That was like a light bulb. The moment of acceptance that this is the way it's going to be. So I have a different mother and I now need to decide how I treat that mother, what the relationship with that mother will be. And I was very willing to give sort of guidelines and from a Jewish perspective, kibbutz av va'em, honoring parents and so on and so forth. But that's a new mother. The mother I thought I had was different. That's no longer there. That's such a powerful, painful, but powerful realization. And that sets the stage, it sets the foundation to be able to work through it. There needs to be that identification. There needs to be recognition of loss. Subtle loss, nuanced loss, big loss, significant loss, long-term loss, short-term loss, whatever the case is. This is day-to-day living. This is more significant. This is kind of a more painful, long-term sort of situation. But when you, it's only when you understand the loss and understand the pain, then you can express it and then you can make a decision to move on and to let go. But as long as you're still hoping, maybe, you haven't let go, the loss hasn't actually hit you, there hasn't been a loss, therefore you can't feel the loss, you can't express the loss, you can't grieve the loss, and therefore you can't move on either. And that's what she means when she says that it's not about what happened, it's about what didn't happen. And let me just read to you one more paragraph. She says the following. She says, I'm a prisoner and a victim when I minimize or deny my pain. And I'm a prisoner and a victim when I hold on to regret. See, it's both ways. Regret is the wish to change the past. It's what we experience when we can't acknowledge that we're powerless, that something already happened and we can't change a single thing. So that's what grief is. Grief is understanding that something happened. We need to first understand it, feel the pain of understanding it, and then make a decision that we are powerless to change it and give up and let go. Which goes into a sort of another concept which we need to really understand. And it's again, it's day-to-day living this. That we know that this concept plays out again in the laws of mourning, that you have to mourn, but you have to let go. There's a period of shiva, but you have to not grieve in excess because then you remain trapped. And where does that grieving in excess actually come from? So she explains that excess grief, and this is a universal concept, that excess and unresolved grief often comes and is connected to the issue of control. Painful subject. We've talked about it many, many, many times. But we need to talk about it many, many more times because giving up control is one of the hardest things that human beings need to do, but they need to do it. We need to give up control. In a Jewish context, it should theoretically be made a little bit easier because when we give up control, we're not letting control go haywire. We're actually giving up control to something higher. We're realizing that it's God who runs the world, and therefore you're realizing that certain things he decides need to happen, giving us, taking away things from us, whatever the case is, and it's up to him and he runs the show, which becomes more liberating and more empowering and more comforting when we finally come to that conclusion. But it's a very hard road because human beings are born to control, and some of us are born to control more than others. And when we don't give up the control, as she writes in the book, she says, when we have unresolved grief, we live with overwhelming rage. In other words, not being able to work through this loss expectation concept, grieving the loss and understanding that it's final, and then identifying it and expressing it and so on. When we don't do that, it's because we don't want to give up control, because grieving is really a process of giving up control. It's saying, it happened, it is lost, I have to accept it. The way I respond is a whole different story, but I have to accept that it happened. When we can't do that, it's about not giving up control, and therefore we still hang on to it, and it's still painful, and it continues to be painful, and what happens is we slip into a rage, slip into anger, because we can't fix it. She tells the following story, I'm going to read it to you. She says, when my grandchildren let me go a drop back. She tells the following. She says the following. Lorna, a patient of hers, I guess, had a brother who drank a lot. One night he went for a walk and was hit by a car and died. A year later, she's struggling to accept that he's gone. I told him not to drink, she says. Why didn't he listen? He was supposed to help me take care of our mother. How could he be so selfish? Right? It's that guilt, it's that anger, it's that blaming. Everything comes together and it all doesn't have to make sense together, but often that's what happens in extreme cases. But we all do it to a certain degree. We blame, we get angry, we put the blame somewhere, we get frustrated and so on, right? She can't change that he was addicted to alcohol, that he kept on drinking despite his family's best efforts to intervene, that he was inebriated when he died. She can't change the thing, and it's hard to accept our powerlessness. This anger is because I told him not to. Why didn't he listen? Because you're not in charge. That's why. And just because you told him doesn't mean it's going to happen. You did the right thing. You did whatever you can. And we should do whatever we can to make a difference. That doesn't mean that we're always going to be able to control the process, and we're not in control. We are powerless. There's a force. There are people who make choices that are outside of us, and there's God ultimately who runs the world, who steers things in a direction where we are powerless, number one, to understand, and powerless to change. That is why, again, using the formula of grief, it's actually such an amazing thing. That part of the grief is we express pain and we're very in pain, or together with that pain comes acceptance. The very first thing a person says after a person is buried at the cemetery is Kaddish. And as I've shared with you many times, Kaddish does not talk about the soul. Kaddish doesn't talk about the person who's passed away. It doesn't talk about any of that. And yet it's so good for us and so good for the soul because it's an acceptance. Yitkadal v'yitkadash means I sanctify God's name. I believe in God. I'm now letting go. I'm feeling the pain. I'm accepting it. I've accepted it. I'm grieving it. I'm going through a process. And then I'm going to give up. But if I don't accept it, I can't give up. But if I do accept it, then I can let it go. I can move beyond. She writes the following. She says, when my children were young, a schoolmate was riding his bike one afternoon when he cut in front of traffic and died. Marianne was asked to talk to his classmates to help them process all the complex feelings that come with loss, the way it forces us into a reckoning with our own mortality, with the fragility of life. She came prepared to address their sadness and fear. She's talking about her daughter. But the students' overwhelming response to the tragedy wasn't sorrow. It was guilt. I could have been nicer to him, they said. How could he have been in my house and instead of riding my bike alone, but I never wanted to invite him over? The students enumerated all the ways that might have prevented this tragedy from happening. And she says something very powerful. She says, by holding themselves responsible, they were seeking control. But as long as they continue to blame themselves, they'd be avoiding their grief. In order to grieve, you've got to give up control. In order to grieve, you have to understand that there's a loss that's beyond your control. Now, this sounds very all very morbid. The point of this discussion today wasn't talking about grief. It was talking about the grief of everyday today living. We can't accept and we can't let go because we want to hang on to control. I'm supposed to fix the world. I'm supposed to be in control. Now, we should try our best to help change ourselves and to inspire others, of course. We can even learn from the past and see how we can do things better. But when something happens, it was meant to happen. If I lost my job, God forbid, I was meant to lose. If a relationship falls apart, it ultimately was meant to happen. We have to go through a process to get there. But that is the truth. Whatever happens in the world ultimately was meant to happen. If I got broken into, God forbid, it was meant to happen. Part of that is giving up control. Identifying the pain, yes. Going through the pain. But acceptance that it's a real loss. It happened. I cannot change it. I cannot change the past. It wasn't me, nor could have I. Ultimately, I could learn to do things better, but I couldn't have really prevented it. Those two things are very subtle and they sort of go together because I can move forward and see I can do things better in the future, and I should and I would and I will. But ultimately, I couldn't have changed it and I couldn't have prevented it. It is what it is. So that's why she says, by holding themselves responsible, they were seeking control. But as long as they continue to blame themselves, they'd be avoiding the grief. Very beautiful line. We don't have control, but we wish we did. Resolving grief means both to release ourselves from responsibility for all the things that weren't up to us and to come to terms with the choices we've made that can't be undone. That's really important. In other words, part of it is even if we did make a bad choice, guilt is not going to change anything. Hanging on to the bad choice that we made is not going to bring it back. What will bring it back is learning from the guilt, positive guilt. Understanding that it happened, I need to accept myself even. feel the pain of why did it have to happen, but feel that pain and then learn to make a difference in the future. But guilt is just a crutch and a paralysis that's not going to bring it back, but it's a form of control. It's a form of, I could have done it differently. Ultimately, no, you couldn't have. Because if something happened, it was meant to happen, even if you made a bad choice. So learn for the future. But of course, we need to make positive choices in the future, but it's not reckless. It's not irresponsible. We do. We have choice. We have to make moral choices that are good and productive and helpful and inspiring. But once something happened, it has happened. We cannot undo the past. Which again highlights and clarifies why in Judaism we have this incredible balance. You see, I'll just share with you an interesting idea. It comes out of actually also of an essay of Rabbi Sacks. Also, many other commentaries talk about this also. There's a very interesting prohibition in the Torah. The prohibition of the Torah is, you need to understand the context. The context is that in biblical times or ancient times, where people were sort of more involved in pagan worship, there was a practiced by many pagan communities that when someone died, they would lacerate themselves, they would hurt themselves, they would draw blood as an expression of their pain and grief and so on and so forth. And the Torah prohibits us against this. The only thing we do, in the context of proper grief, is we tear a garment as a sign of grief. But it's interesting, a garment is sort of more external, more superficial. But we don't injure ourselves as an expression of grief, and we're forbidden to do that. But when the Torah says that, it gives an explanation, and it says, you are children of the Lord your God. Do not cut yourselves or shave the front of your heads for the dead, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. This prohibition, God connects it with holiness. Because you're a holy people, therefore, don't injure yourself as an expression of grief. And the question is, why? What's holiness got to do with that? But of course, as the commentaries explain, and the many commentaries give different perspectives, different sort of ways, but it boils down to the following. Restraining and preventing excess mourning is a form and expression of holiness. Why? God says, I've chosen you, the chosen nation. What's it got to do with it? And the answer is very simple. It's got to do exactly what we talked about before. In a Jewish context, this concept of giving up control and accepting that which has happened, which therefore creates what the Talmud talks about, the balance of grief. Yes, you got to mourn for 7 days, but then you got to get up. You got to do something else for another 30 days, and then you got to stop. You got to move from stage to stage. Very similar to the modern day contemporary stages of grief, but the Torah mandates it and pushes a person through those different stages. And both of them are important, as we've said 100 times. In other words, the first one you have to, otherwise you're insensitive. The second one, if you grieve in excess, it's considered terrible. Why is it considered terrible? Because ultimately, as much as grief is so important, and the Torah says it's so important to identify the pain, express it and share it, and go through the process of grieving, excess grief is about guilt and control. And holding on to control is the most un-Jewish thing we could do. Because Judaism, in the Jewish philosophy context, is all about belief in God. It's all about understanding that God runs the world and our reality. It's all about understanding what the Talmud says, that Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven. In other words, we have free choice, but the choice is only to make moral choices. But ultimately what happens is not up to us. Acceptance is a form of belief in God. It's a form of holiness. It's a form of letting go and connecting to something higher. You see, because when we let go of ourselves, when we let go of control, we're letting go of our own prison. When letting go of our own prison, we're able to connect to something higher than us. As long as we hang on to control, that obsession with controlling things is a barrier between us and a higher being. Between us and holiness, between us and growth, between us and extending ourselves beyond who we are, connecting to a higher being, connecting to God and godliness, and the teachings of His Torah, mitzvot, and so on and so forth. Because the first step is to understand that we are in His hands. We are run by Him, which is a good thing, not a bad thing. He runs the world, and ultimately He knows what He's doing. Sometimes it's very painful. Sometimes we don't have to understand, nor should we. But nevertheless, ultimately, when we come to terms, whether it's a loss of a relationship, whether it's a realization that the expectations we had of people is no longer going to be there. And we say to ourselves, why me? Why is it? Because you don't control the world. So therefore, the Torah says, do not express, do not engage in excess grief, which in those times also was in the context, it also meant this practice. Do not engage in this practice of injuring yourself as a form of grief, because that means you're making something permanent, you're hurting yourself, you're hanging on to the grief, because you're hanging on to the pain, because you're hanging on to the denial and the non-acceptance, because you're hanging on to guilt and control. And therefore, that's not holy. So you're a holy people, you're a chosen nation, therefore don't do that. Learn to believe, learn to express pain. Don't understand. I'm not asking you to understand, says God. But I'm asking you to identify, share, express what you're feeling, and then respond. And then move on. And that is true with every single grief. We have to go through that process. If it's a story of that mother where we come to the conclusion where the mother is no longer the mother I thought I had, it's come to the conclusion, accept it, give it finality, feel the pain, express the pain, share the pain, and then make a decision. I cannot do anything about the past. I can now only accept it and move forward, because I am not in control. I am connected to God, and God runs the show. But of course, this theme has to go a little bit deeper. And I'm going to read to you just one final part of the of this chapter. She says the following. Grief has so many layers and flavors. Sorrow, fear, relief, survivor's guilt, existential questioning, diminished safety, fragility. Our whole sense of the world is interrupted and rearranged. The adage says time heals all wounds, but I disagree, she says, which is beautiful. Time doesn't heal, it's what you do with the time. So here comes the switch, you see. Once we accept and we let go of control, which then ultimately means we let go of the past, which comes through acceptance and grieving. We let go of what we thought we had and we no longer have. We then move to the future. And we know in the future, we can't control the future either, but we can make a difference to the future through moral choices, which God has given us. So time doesn't heal wounds. What we do with the time does. And she says, sometimes people compensate for the upheaval of grief by trying to keep everything the same. Jobs, routines, relationships remain static. But when you had a big loss, nothing is the same anymore. Listen to this. Listen to what she says. Grief can be an invitation to revisit our priorities and decide again to reconnect to our joy and purpose. Reconnect to being the best we can be right now, to embrace that life is pointing us in a new direction. Such an important thing. You know, we talk about it in the context of COVID. People say, you know, when are we going to go back to normal? We should never go back to normal. Because that is not why we go through a difficult time, to go back to normal. And pretending that we're going to be normal is wrong. And in fact, it almost makes it worthless and just a complete waste of time. Because we need to understand that when we go through something, as painful as it is, as hard as it is to go through whatever it is, a minor thing or a major thing, a short-term thing or a long-term thing, the stage after we've grieved, felt the pain, accepted it, decided to move on, moving on doesn't mean going back to normal. Because although we may never and should never understand what happened, but we can, as we said before, we can give what happened meaning and purpose. We can dig deeper into the recesses of our soul and discover what resilience really means. And resilience is often translated as bouncing back. But it's actually inaccurate. It doesn't mean bouncing back. It means coming back with greatness, with something greater. There's a principle we've talked about many times, which is mentioned a lot in Hasidic philosophy, of Yerida Tzorech Aliyah. Every time we have a descent, it's for the purpose of an ascent. It's for the purpose of climbing higher than we were before. As to use her words, it can be an invitation to revisit our priorities, to decide again, to reconnect to our joy and purpose, to recommit to being the best we can right now, to embrace that life is pointing us in a new direction. You know, in 1977, the Lubavitcher Rebbe suffered a heart attack. It's a famous story. He was surrounded by lots of doctors. It was a very, very serious heart attack, actually. One from which he had a miraculous recovery. And there are many, many anecdotes and stories that came out of that period of time. It was actually on Shmini Atzeret, just the day before Simchat Torah, that it happened. There was a huge crowd in New York had come to visit for the holidays. It's a long story in its own right. The Rebbe at that time refused to go to the hospital. So the hospital came to him. They set up in his room a whole ICU unit, and he wanted to be surrounded by his followers and Hasidim and so on and so forth. And a long, long story, he remained there until actually the 1st of Kislev, which is next week. And that's when he returned home for the first time. And that was, since then it's been celebrated each year. But many stories came out of that whole story. One of them was conversations that he had with doctors, wanting to understand things, offering his own medical input because he was very well read and knowledgeable and so on. They've told it over many times. It's some fascinating things. One of them is they had to take a lot of blood tests. So the Rebbe asked them, how does it work? So they said to him, it works because you put in a syringe and there's no air and it creates a vacuum, and the vacuum pulls, because there's a vacuum in the syringe, it pulls blood. So he said, from everything we have to learn a lesson. And he said that he had a letter from someone that had written to him that he'd gone through a very flat period, a very empty period, a very painful period. And the Rebbe told him that when you experience something like that, if you went through a time where you think it's a time of hollowness, of emptiness, it's actually a very powerful time to draw new vitality, new life, which was the symbol of the blood being born. And he put that into practice. This was in 1977, and the 80s, although he was very elderly already by then, the 80s was one of the most powerful decade of the Rebbe's leadership, where he worked his followers even harder, came up with new innovations, spread the word throughout the world, and the explosion of inspiration that came throughout the whole world, and all of the different campaigns that he led, a lot of them, or most of them even, were specifically after that event, because he was determined not to go back to normal, not to regress for sure, not to go back to normal, but to go back much greater. We need to learn that lesson now also. We're coming out of COVID, hopefully. Talking about a vaccine or therapeutics, whatever the case is, we should never go back to normal. There's so many things that we can learn. Even from the challenging times that we all had, we should never go back to normal. We should go back greater. So therefore, he says, it's the same with our own, therefore it's the same with our little grief that we have every single day. We need to understand it's not just about letting go. It's about letting go and emerging with greater strength, with the power of resilience. And the power of resilience is not just bouncing back to where we were before, but the power of resilience is to the reveal from the infinity of our soul, the part of our soul that is so undefined, that is such a clean slate, that is so pure, that is so great and strong and infinite, to reveal greater and more infinite potential to achieve things and do things and connect to things that we weren't able to do before we went through that challenging time, before we went through that period of emptiness. So therefore, just in summary, just to put it all together, we started off with the story of the two women. So the first thing is we need to know that often when we're very frustrated and we're very angry and we're very agitated, it's because something else is at play. So we're upset about something else which we still have to identify. And we've buried it so that we don't actually notice it. So therefore, we identify it, stage one. Then we have to understand that it's like the grieving process. We have to go through the grief by understanding that it's final, by giving up control, and therefore feeling the pain, identifying the pain, expressing the pain, every situation in its own way, whether it's someone else. But by the way, when I talk about expressing pain again, I don't mean to broadcast it. I mean to express it to someone that you could trust, to a mentor, to a friend, to yourself, whatever the case might be, with the sole purpose of not hanging onto it, expressing it, feeling it for not hanging onto it. Because to give up control, to understand that it's final, and to really move through and transition through to that stage we can get to give up control and to understand that we cannot change the past and to accept that our expectation is no longer there. But then, of course, it's to move on, but to move on, not to go back to normal, but to bounce back a lot stronger and a lot more powerful, to make our lives even that much more meaningful and purposeful and so much deeper. So that's the lesson that's coming out from this, what she calls the prison of unresolved grief. We'll leave it for there. There's a lot more great chapters in the book, which we're going to go through over the next coming weeks. So for now, have a wonderful day, everyone, and a good week, and a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Fantastic.
Thank you, everyone.